This past year has had so many sad moments, and there's sadness that's that unfortunately is still to be found, continuing with many people who are not well. And yet, in some way, we've sort of discovered each other in different places, different parts of the country, of the world, that we otherwise normally wouldn't have met. Now, this is not a normal way to meet. I'll tell you the truth, I don't have a computer, I only have a phone. So I can only see like 2-3 people. I guess I'll try to move it around. I've done thousands of these Zooms. I'm not so good with it. So please forgive me. I go on a little tour every now and then. And I want to, I'm sure there's a way that I could see a person who's talking. I guess they'll go on to that person. The green will go on to that person. So please forgive me if I'm a little bit clumsy with this. Ben was very sweet what he said, but it's not 30 years. That's an old thing that was written up somewhere. It's already close to 42, 43 years that I've had the unbelievable privilege. It has to be updated, Benjamin.
Okay.
My beard is already white, and I have, thank God, a lot of grandchildren. My love for people, my love for my fellow Jews, and my excitement to talk to you and to meet you in this, even though it's a strange way to meet, hasn't gotten any weaker. I just look forward to the day that we'll be able to meet together in a good place, maybe even in Jerusalem. That would be nice. I would say I'll take you all out to eat, and it's on me, but I don't know if I could afford that, but we'll get together somehow. It could be arranged, and we could actually talk in person. So in the meantime, I didn't come here to give speeches, to give lectures. Anybody that wants to hear any of those, there are thousands of them. I'm sure Ben can tell you where to find them, but that are online or all over. But I want to hear what's on your minds, and just for a little bit of time to talk, a little bit to share. And I beg of you, please, to speak your minds. And nobody should be shy. And if I say anything that's in any way, if you feel it in any way that it's harsh or that it's something that you're having a problem with, don't worry about being critical and you could yell at me, you could do whatever you want. I don't take it personally, and I don't mean anything personally. It's just a couple of Jews at the end of history waiting to greet Messiah who want to schmooze a little bit, who are talking a little bit. So if I can help in any way, let's get started.
All right, so I'm going to get started with one of the questions that was submitted in advance by one of the participants here. And this is recording, so I trust that Moshe Nyhaus, again, appreciate you putting all of this together. I see Yoel Gabay, the founder of My Jewish Question, also on the line. So thank both of you for everything you did to make this possible. And so I'm going to start off with the first question. I think Moshe also put in the chat that people can submit additional questions now. So Moshe will highlight for me which ones we could get to and help make the order. I'm going to start with one question we got in advance, which is this. Somebody here asked, when my family and I met with an Orthodox rabbi and his wife, I noticed that the rabbi shook my hand and not my wife's, and the rabbitson shook, the rabbi's wife, shook my wife's hand, but not my own. What's the big deal about men and women shaking hands? Isn't a handshake just a handshake?
Yeah. You know, that question, it's a great question. Isn't a handshake just a handshake? You know, that would have been, if that question would have been asked even 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, I think that it would have been a different response. But I think in America here, we've already learned that a handshake is not always just a handshake, and that there are boundaries that are not kept carefully. And most powerful people here in the state of New York, one of the most powerful people in the country right now, is suffering from something that a few years ago wouldn't have even raised an eyebrow as far as crossing boundaries. So the Torah and our sages had unbelievable foresight and understood human nature, and they know that for the most part, a handshake is something which is completely, completely innocent. They know that. But they also know that there are circumstances, there are conditions, especially in a workplace, especially when a woman is is in the presence of a man who could be manipulative or controlling, sometimes vice versa, but particularly when a woman is in the presence of a manipulative person, like what's happening right now in New York State, this whole conversation over the governor, where even the slightest sign of physical contact or intimacy is for that individual who is the predator, that could be an entrance into very, very dangerous territory, dangerous waters. So our rabbis decided the following. Even though it's true, according to Jewish law, there are many rabbis, by the way, that say that according to Jewish law, if it's completely non-affectionate, if it's just a business-like shake of the hand, there are those who say that under those circumstances, it's not ideal, but under those circumstances, it's okay. You certainly don't want to insult the woman or to insult the man. We don't want anybody to be insulted. And therefore, many rabbis, according to Jewish law, permit that in a formal type of a business setting. They permit it. Most other rabbis were weary of that more lenient opinion, because it's hard to judge exactly when it comes to these things. For one person, we've learned this over the past few years, that for one person, something could be perceived as completely harmless, and for the other person, it's not. It's the beginning of some effort to make to cross over that boundary that leads towards, God forbid, something more serious, towards some attempt to attempted seduction. So, therefore, the rabbis felt, we have an expression in the Talmud. It's in Aramaic. It says lo plug. Lo plug means it's best not to make distinctions, to make a rule across the board. This way, under all circumstances, those boundaries are kept in a healthy way. And we don't, and therefore, even though many, many times it's totally harmless, it's not anything, and nobody means anything. And it's not a way of showing any affection. That's why you can hand the change over to the girl in the grocery store, the girl to the guy in over the counter, can hand the change, even though there might be a second, they might touch hands. That's not it. But handshaking in different cultures is not always just a very formal, cold type of an encounter. It could mean something else. And I've learned over the years that from the most harmless type of interchanges, from the most harmless I have seen, and I've dealt with this, that there have been some people who ended up regretting things in a very deep way. So it's not totally against the law, but it's preferable to keep that distance. But sometimes if there's a situation where one of it would be very hurt or insulted, and the circumstances are really businesslike, there are those who permit such a thing. But the rabbi and the rabbitson were doing well by creating that kind of a barrier, because for those people in that position, they have to be very, very careful that they should remain rabbinical and to not to cross over the lines of behaving in a rabbinical way. I even when it comes to not with men and women, even when it comes to the guys, you know, there was a rabbi in New York that lost his position because he would go to the Schwitz. You know what a Schwitz is? How do you say a Schwitz? Steam. I forgot what you call it. We call it a Schwitz in Yiddish. It means to go, like they have a bathhouse. You know, a sauna, right? A sauna. thank you for putting. So they were wearing bathing suits, I guess, or towels. But the rabbi, you know, you're teaching Torah. You're supposed to try to represent something which is holy. You're supposed to be a person to look up to. There's nothing wrong with taking your schwitz, you know, going to a sauna. But you don't go with your congregants to the sauna. So the rabbi and rabbitson were doing what's absolutely right, according to Jewish law. Under different circumstances, there's some room for leniency.
Thank you, Rabbi Weinberger. I noticed that I see Sally Simon mentioned on the chat, she's experienced this exact situation, even involving a handshake, that it was, you know, crossing over a little bit in a way that it shouldn't be, not completely innocent. We'll just ask everybody again, if you could please change your names, right click on your own picture, or your own icon, and change your name to be your name and your city, and turn on your video. So we can get
and your volume's a little down.
Yeah, now it's your volume.
Right.
Yeah.
Sometimes this...
Yeah, it slips.
Mic just gets low. Sorry about that. If everybody could turn their name changed to their name and their city, leave it to turn your video on so we could see everybody. And Moshe put in the chat some instructions on how to raise your hand in the chat. So if you could like raise your hand and then we can maybe call on somebody for a live question. If you put on the icon to raise your hand, that'll enable Moshe to know when the right time comes to unmute you and we can have a live question later on. In the meantime, I'm going to go to the second question from those that have been previously submitted, which is, why is Judaism so obsessed with tiny, insignificant details? How much matzah do we have to eat? Which spoon did I use for milk and which one for meat? What is the right way to tie my shoelaces? Aren't they missing the bigger picture and calling their nitpicking spirituality?
Okay, I think that's also a fantastic question. And I think all of us who stop and think about these things feel that sometimes. It's very much connected, by the way, to the last question. And I'll tell you how. To the question about shaking hands. Shaking hands is also a tiny, insignificant little ritual that takes place in a social setting. It's a ritual. It's very, very insignificant. But something which appears to be just a tiny little ritual, depending upon the parties who are involved and the intentions, can take on tremendous significance. You know, there are certain codes between a husband and wife. There are certain signs that people who know each other and love each other for a long period of time that to other people would seem to be very petty or insignificant, and they wouldn't even understand what they mean. But for the parties who are sharing that secret, this tiny little gesture has galactic significance. That's number one. Number two, as one begins to study Torah more and more, especially when you enter into the depths of the hidden part of Torah, the teachings of mysticism, of Kabbalah, and in that place of study, you open up the texts, the ancient texts, and you realize that every tiny, tiny little detail, the same way that when it comes to an exquisite painting by Da Vinci, that every tiny little detail on the painting, affects the entire picture that you're looking at, the entire portrait that you're looking at by that tiny little detail. And in a symphony orchestra, if there's one violin, if there's one chord, if there's one note that's not synchronized with the other musicians, the entire song is off. The way that God made the world is such that all of these, what seem to be these nitpicking tiny details, are intimate, great, deep, intimate codes and signs of God's love for each and every one of us. And if a person studies them and learns what these codes mean and goes deeply into the codes, then you understand how each one of these is making a connection to God, is making a connection to our families, to other Jews throughout the world. You understand more about it. However, I will back you up on what you said in the question, that oftentimes what happens is that many of our co-religionists get completely caught up in the trees and they lose sight of the forest. And Ben is over here and he knows that for all of these years, I'm screaming and kicking and fighting and yelling about this problem that of it's wonderful. We should keep all of the laws, but those laws were not meant to take away from the romance of our relationship with God. And oftentimes it does. That doesn't mean that one should stop keeping those laws. It means that they need to be kept in perspective. And keeping them in perspective, number one, understanding their significance, their deeper meaning, their symbolism, what they are. That's number one. And number two, not allowing those tiny little details to take over one's religion, one's commitment to God, to take over in such a way where there's no longer any emotion, there's no longer any feeling, there's no longer any connection. It's just empty, nitpicking rituals. They themselves, the rituals are not empty. They have tremendous significance. But when a person uses those as an excuse to avoid making eye contact with the Creator. And instead of making that eye contact, instead of it being something which is deep and significant and real in your life, all you do is you spend around your whole, you spend, I spoke in a very beautiful shul in a beautiful synagogue a few years ago. I was invited to speak out of town. And they just told me, they told me that they spent $14 million on fixing up the shul. So I said to the people that were there, this is why I began this speech. As I said, you know, you spent $14 million to build this beautiful place. I really hope you're davening in it. I really hope you're praying. I really hope you're using it well, because a lot of Judaism has become beautiful buildings, and the rituals have become emptied of feeling and emotion. That's not what God intended. When he gave us the Torah on Mount Sinai, it was with fire, it was with lightning, it was with love. It was face to face, it was heart to heart. It wasn't a bunch of laws that are just an excuse for a relationship. You have that oftentimes in a family as well, that the parents and the children, husbands and wives, that it's become a life of just chores, carpools. I remember there's an old Paul Simon. I don't know if you ever heard of Simon and Garfunkel. I know this might be, I think they're timeless. By this point, they're already timeless. So Paul Simon has lyrics in the song that says, "I know a woman who became a wife." Those were the very words she used to describe her life. A woman who became a wife. What does that mean? It means she married, she wanted to be more of a woman with her husband, that should develop in her femininity, should develop her being a woman. But somehow over the years, she's become a wife. Now there's no dishonor in being a wife, but she's mourning the loss of her womanhood. She's become a wife, maybe a mother, but she's not a woman anymore. God did not intend for us to become a bunch of religious practitioners. His intention was for us to have a romantic, deep relationship with him, and that these details, these rituals would enhance the relationship, would deepen the relationship. It's very hard for you to feel that they're doing that unless you really learn what they mean and you really go into it. But I promise you that if you do that, then you'll realize that there's just unbelievable, unbelievable beauty to it and depth to it. Unbelievable beauty and depth to it.
Thank you, Rabbi Weinberger. I'm going to go, I think Moshe's going to look at this new question that came in on the chat. So I'm going to go to question number three in the meantime, while he reviews that. And again, ask, you know, will it be wonderful if more people could turn the video on also, so we could see everyone's faces, reactions, be a little bit drop more like a live crowd. So I recently experienced my first Friday night meal and was surprised to see that the Kiddush blessing was said over a cup of wine. In many other religions, wine, alcohol is strictly forbidden. How can Judaism believe that something which leads to indulgence and drunkenness can be considered holy?
Okay, good. We just had our holiday of Purim, and that question is asked every year, especially by Purim. God expects us and demands of us self-control. Wine, when taken in proper measure, by the way, I don't drink wine at Kiddush. I use grape juice. I'm not comfortable with wine. I never drink alcohol. Just as a disclaimer, I want to make it clear that I am disgusted by drinking. Drinking is something which I find to be, when it's not in the right measure, which often it's not, I find to be something which is unbelievably distasteful. And it's certainly, again, it's found many places in the Talmud. Drunkenness, excessive drinking, is criticized as something which is extraordinarily dangerous and against the will of God. However, you're right. When a couple gets married, it's over a cup of wine. When we make kiddush, it's over a cup of wine. When a baby is born and there's a bris, a baby boy, at the bris, it's over a cup of wine. Now, there are many reasons for that. I'll tell you one of the deeper reasons, and it'll just for now, hopefully it will help a little bit. According to the Kabbalists, the sin that took place in the Garden of Eden was not an apple. There was no apple in the Garden of Eden. Adam and Eve had grapes, and they, according to the Kabbalists, there was wine that they had, they made a l'chaim with a snake. They were drinking wine. And ever since then, all those things that took place at the beginning of time, throughout history, our responsibility is to try to refine and to correct those ancient mistakes, things that need, that Hashem, that God wanted in the world, should be lifted up to a higher place. Wine, when it's in measure in the right way, it says in the verse in Psalms, Yain yisamach levav enosh, that wine has the ability, when it's a little bit of wine, it has the ability to take an edge off of a person, off of a certain stress, sadness, and to open up a person's heart. But there's no question that our rabbis agree that in those situations where drinking has become a form of recreation, and it leads to misbehavior and ugliness and so on, that's absolutely not what they had in mind. So when we drink by the Kiddush, those people who have wine, our sages taught, Mishenichnas yayin yetzei sod. That means when a person drinks wine, a little bit of wine, secrets begin to come out. Now, if you're a person who, and you contain within you secrets of love of God and deep secrets of holiness and pureness, then a little bit of wine will bring out those secrets. But if your secret is something which best be kept to yourself, you shouldn't be drinking at all. You should have a seltzer instead and make a l'chaim over a seltzer.
Thank you, Rabbi. We have a question that came through the chat just now from Shlomi Ben Naim. I think that's a man's name, so I'm going to say he said, I have been listening to a well-known rabbi for many years. In almost every lecture, he says that breaking Shabbat is worse than murder, and not keeping Shabbat, you basically lose all your Jewish rights. What is your opinion?
My opinion is that you shouldn't listen to that rabbi anymore. I don't know why you've been listening to him for many years. I would recommend that you switch channels and go to hear somebody that's speaking the language of 2021 and the Torah that God wants to be revealed to our generation. A person that breaks Shabbos. Shabbos is a very foundational part of Judaism. It's true. The Sabbath is very, very important for reasons that we don't have time to go into right now. It's a very, very big part of Judaism. The vast majority of Jews these days who are not observing Shabbos, it's not because they're violating it. It's because they were not raised with Shabbos, nor do they know what it is. Nobody's guilty as charged and worthy of being brought to the guillotine for doing something that they don't understand. And even if a person nowadays has learned more about Shabbos and has studied it, we're not living in a society or in a culture where Shabbos is widely respected and kept. And that affects all of us. Therefore, this rabbi, I'm sorry, whoever he is, God should forgive him for saying these things. He should not be speaking about punishments. He should be teaching the people who are listening to him about the beauty of Shabbos, of how unbelievable it is when a Jew tries to do even the tiniest little bit on Shabbos to make Shabbos different than the rest of the week. There's no talk here about punishments, about dying. That's absolutely sick. It's sick to talk about such things publicly. Now, is there any truth to that? No. As I said before, even in the days when we had the temple and we had the great court in Jerusalem, it was just about unheard of that a Jew was ever executed for violation of Shabbos. There were always extenuating circumstances that he did not keep Shabbos. And if that was thousands of years ago, it's a million times more now that people are not breaking Shabbos. They don't appreciate it. They don't know what it is. It's not that they're breaking Shabbos. Nobody is guilty and put to death for going against something that they don't understand, they don't know about. And even if they were raised and taught about it, it doesn't mean they know the depth of what Shabbos is. That is a rabbi that you should not listen to. Shlomi, stay away. Turn to a different station. Wrong. Delete.
Thank you, Rabbi. Bina Yocheved wrote just a few minutes ago in the chat, I work in the field of veterinary medicine. I know that some Orthodox Jews don't approve of pets in the home. I'd love to hear your opinion on this, even though I know it seems like a silly question.
No, it's not silly. It's not silly at all. I'm asked that question very often. Look, this is not, we're not talking here about a sin. You understand? I want to make that clear. It's not sinful to have a pet. Unless like you like to have an alligator in your living room. It's not sinful to have a pet. There are a number of concerns. Let me go through one or two of them. The first concern is that a Jewish home is supposed to be hospitable and welcoming. And you might think that your pit bull is very friendly and you love it and you like to cuddle up with it and so on and sit by the fireplace and play cards together. But there are a lot of people who are going to come into your house and they're terrified of that dog. They're absolutely terrified. Therefore, I've seen this very often. I personally am not comfortable with dogs. My parents are Holocaust survivors. My parents were traumatized by German shepherds in Auschwitz and in Mauthausen. I was raised in terror of dogs. I'm just telling you, that's how I was raised. To my parents, dogs were the embodiment of evil and brought back triggered memories of Nazis and dogs attack that were set to attack Jews as they were getting off the cattle car in concentration camp. So I have a natural feeling of tremendous distance and fear from a man's best friend. They were never my best friend at all. And I was raised to be very, very careful. Now, I understand and appreciate that a person likes that company. And I know there's animal therapy, Horace dog therapy. And I understand that with many children, that it can be very, very helpful. And I respect that. I appreciate that. But I have found that over the years that I will walk into a house and I will have a huge dog come licking me and sniffing at me. And I don't like that. And I don't think that it's right for a visitor to be in any way frightened or intimidated just because you feel, oh, this dog wouldn't hurt anybody. This dog never hurt anybody. That's fine for you, but that might not be the most hospitable way to open up your house to somebody. So that's one thing. That's one thing that a dog that could be scary, an animal that could be scary. That's not the trademark of Jewish hospitality in a house. Even though the owner always feels that my dog is the best dog in the world. My dog is so friendly and so kind and so on. My son was just reading to me last week from a newspaper about how many friendly dogs in the United States cause deaths of children, babies, and even adults in one year. You wouldn't believe that there are thousands of deaths that take place through pets, pet dogs, thousands of deaths. So if somebody has a fish tank, if somebody has something that doesn't intrude upon another person's feeling of safety or well-being. Not everybody likes to have a cat crawling around their ankles, also sniffing and coming around. The owner is convinced that my cat is a tzaddik, is a righteous and holy saint, is a transmigration of Rabbi Akiva, and my cat is so beautiful. How could anybody not be absolutely in love with my cat? I kiss my cat, I hug my cat, my cat eats with me at the table. I would have things to say about that type of behavior, but it's not for this Zoom right now. But I'm not judging those people at all. All I'm saying is that not everybody feels that way. I'm sorry to tell all the pet lovers, not everybody feels that way. So if it's a pet that is not intrusive, that doesn't bother other people, that doesn't threaten other people, the Torah is not against that. There is another issue that when you're making blessings, according to Jewish law, if your hands are scratching a dog or a cat, an animal, and there could be a problem with the hands being unclean when it comes to making a blessing, or saying Shema, and so on. That's another issue. But I would say intrinsically, there's nothing wrong. It's just, does that dog belong in the same room where people are praying, where people are studying Torah? So there were many, many Kabbalists that felt that an impure animal does not belong, an impure animal, as much affection if you have for this animal, an impure animal does not belong in the same room where Jews are praying, where people are studying Torah. But there's nothing essentially wrong if you keep it away a little bit and you enjoy having the company of a pet. If it's not a threat or bother to other people, there's nothing essentially wrong with that.
Thank you, Rabbi. I'm going to ask if we could have a few more people also putting the video on, putting your names in. We'd love to see a little bit more.
How many people are on here?
It's 47 total.
Oh, okay. Right now.
47 total. But many, many, you know, we don't have the camera on, so we can't see them. But
right.
Okay, I'm going to ask another question here. It was submitted beforehand. It seems like a woman asking this question. She writes, I have been seriously hurt by my ex. It has now been 7 months of abuse, put downs, bad mouthing, and humiliation. And I have remained silent. But now I have an overwhelming urge to take revenge. And I have the chance. With one phone call, I could ruin his career and shatter his entire life. Should I do it?
Wow. Wow. Ay, ay, ay. First of all, I hope there's some legal way to put an end to this abuse that you're suffering, and that you'll be able to finally have some peace from this person. That's the first thing. The question is, seeking such revenge and potentially destroying this person's life, as sweet as that revenge would be, it's not generally promoted as an ideal type of behavior. However, I will tell you that our sages taught that when a person is enraged, when a person is abused, that he's not held accountable for acting in ways that are atypical of how he or she would normally behave. That doesn't mean to kill somebody. I can't say anything by way of Jewish law if I don't know all the details of the situation. But I would say the following to whoever you are. I would say you're probably a long-suffering, exceptionally wonderful and noble person. And when a wonderful, noble person engages in such behavior of revenge, even if it for a moment or for a day or two feels exciting and sweet, and there's some satisfaction that comes with that. If you're a truly deep, ethical, moral, upstanding person, in the long run, that's not something that's going to add to your life. It's not a matter of not destroying his life, whether he deserves for his life to be destroyed. I would leave that up to the creator of the world to take him out of his job. I would leave that up to the creator to decide how he should be judged. But it would be lowering yourself. It would be something that's undignified for a person of your stature to stoop to the behavior of this ex of yours, and to yourself become somebody that engages in this type of warfare. My father, may he rest in peace, his way was always to try to take the high road. And I have found in life that there have been many times that there are people who have done things to hurt me. And I was very tempted to get back, and I had ways of getting back. But I always hear my father saying to me, Maisha, it's only going to make you into one of them. Don't become one of them. Just take the high road. God runs the world. And if that person is not punished in this world for what he's done to you, I'm saying this to you, to this woman, then he'll be taken care of in other ways by the master of the world. Don't take that into your own hands, because it's not becoming for you. It's just not becoming. You're not that kind of a person, and don't become that kind of a person. Then if you do that, then the abuse is continuing, because now he has made you into a person that's vengeful. You know, we're about to celebrate Passover, Pesach, and in the Haggadah, one of the things that we read about our exile in Egypt was Vayareu Osanu. It means that they did evil to us, but what the Egyptians did evil to the Jewish slaves. But one of the interpretations is that the worst thing they did to us is they made us into people who were less sensitive to evil. They made us people who were less sensitive to evil, to Ra. So if you take revenge, it might give you some satisfaction, but he will have succeeded into making you into a person that you're not. And that's how the abuse continues, and it continues and continues. Leave it in God's hands. It'll be much better off. You'll be a much happier person long term.
Thank you, Rabbi. I'm going to call on Sue now to ask a question, and Moshe's going to open up the mic.
Sue from Georgia?
Well, visiting my son in Georgia, yes.
Okay, hi.
Hi. Kristen had a message on there that she doesn't know how to turn the camera on.
Moshe, if you could help with the camera question.
Yeah, so we just on the corner, you'll see you have a mute button next to them's video.
I saw that in the message. So there's people that you want to be on there, and it's just she's on her phone.
Oh, okay. So you should see a function on the bottom. But Subia, you have a question for the rabbi, or that was the point you wanted to make?
That's the point I wanted to make.
Okay.
You wanted to come on.
Thank you.
I'm thoroughly enjoying this.
Thank you, Sue.
Enjoy your stay over there.
Atlanta's a beautiful city, 4 hours from my hometown of Nashville. I'm going to go to another question that was submitted beforehand. Somebody wrote this. I have several addictions. I don't want to go through all of them here, but the point is I've been struggling getting off and then back on, going for therapy, getting my life together, and then watching it crumble again through the thick haze of my self-abuse. And this has been going on now for some 20 years. I don't see it going anywhere. I made a decision at one point to try to be a good Jew, tefillin, Shabbat, kosher, the whole bit. Sometimes I manage to do that. Sometimes I crash and it falls apart. Sometimes I just stay in bed for weeks, afraid of what I might do if I get out. So what has it all helped me? Whatever I do, I remain a miserable sinner. Sometimes more miserable, sometimes less. But what does God want with sinners like me? What did he put such a louse of a creature here for? I just want to know, does he appreciate all the efforts I put in trying not to be what I am?
I don't know how to respond to this without crying. I don't know who you are, but don't you ever use words like that about yourself to talk about yourself in such a way. If you're in this world, it means that God wants you to be in this world every second. And that means that every tiny, for a person like yourself who struggled with addictions, who I view as the most heroic people in my life, because every step, tiny little baby step that you make to get out of bed and to get moving and to keep 1 second of Shabbat, of Shabbos, to try to do one holy act, to try to stay away for 1 second from that which is wrong, in God's eyes, that's the most unbelievable, cataclysmic, earth-shattering, and holy thing. It's the most unbelievable thing. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Look, this is a very painful question. You're a lot of pain. And I can't help you in this kind of a venue. It's not possible. Let me teach you something from our Torah, and maybe this will help you. In the Torah, there's a complicated law that has to do with a woman who's suspected of being unfaithful to her husband, and the Torah tells us that she's accused of being unfaithful. Now, this is a woman that was warned not to go alone with this man, and not to be careful not to fraternize with this person anymore. And she went ahead and she did it. Again, it's complicated. I'm not going to all the details, but I want to tell you one thing. What's fascinating about this? According to the law, if in the end she is innocent, is determined that she's innocent, and there's a test to find out. It's not important to know what that is. If she's innocent, God blesses her with all kinds of wonderful things in her life, without going into it. She's blessed with all kinds of fantastic things. One of the great rabbis asked, why is she to be blessed? After all, she did ignore the warnings and she was alone with that man. And she did go into a place that seemed to be for the purpose of having relations with this individual. So why, if she turns out to be innocent, why is she blessed? So one of the great rabbis taught an amazing thing. He said, could you imagine? She ignored all the warnings. The witnesses that came and told her, you are not allowed to do this. And she went alone with this man who she's probably crazy in love with and is dying to be together with. And at the last moment, she said, I can't do this. I'm not going to do this. I won't do it. And because of that, she's blessed with the greatest blessings of the Torah. Now, you could ask a question. Listen, this is not exactly a righteous woman, you know, based upon what she's doing. What's so righteous about this that God blesses her in such a way? And the answer is, and I want you to hear this, because when a person is suffering with addictions, temptations, with all kinds of things in life that he didn't want and he doesn't want, but he's being pulled and pulled and pulled year after year, and he makes an effort in that situation that he's in to stay away for a minute. Like this woman, she said to this guy, I got to get out of here. I'm not doing this with you. Today, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to do it. 1 second that a person turns the computer away from that bad thing, 1 second that a person, even a second for a person who's in that fight, in that war, is like the rest of us putting on tefillin every day of our lives. You hear this? It's like me putting on tefillin every day of my life. When you, for 1 minute, you pull yourself and you get up out of bed and you put on tefillin, it's like me doing it my whole life. That's how precious it is, Tasha. You're not a louse. You're not a sinner. You're a fighter. You're a fighter. Many people in your situation would have taken their own lives, God forbid. God forbid. Many people in their own lives wouldn't be asking questions and trying and struggling. You are a heroic fighter. You did not put yourself into this situation. The circumstances are from the beginning of time that you had to go through this in life. And your responsibility now is not to put on tefillin every day, not to be the holiest rabbi. Your responsibility is try to get yourself out of bed and try to do the best you can. And even if you fall again and again and again, you pick yourself up, you wipe yourself off, you dust yourself off, and you move, you try to go forward. And if you do that for the rest of your life, when it comes time at 120 and you go to the next world, you are going to be welcomed by the angels as being one of the greatest heroes of our generation. I promise you.
Thank you. I wanted to save some of these heavier questions for after we got warmed up a little bit. So we have another one here. After our daughter was born, my husband and I didn't have children for many years. Then we were finally blessed with a beautiful boy. I had big plans for him. He was going to be a doctor, maybe a lawyer. He was going to marry a lovely Jewish girl and give me many beautiful grandchildren. Well, my plan is not working out. My son, now 5 years old, was diagnosed with severe autism a year ago. He's 5 years old and nonverbal. He cannot dress himself. He uses diapers around the clock. He cannot communicate with signs or pictures, as it is all too complicated for him. He communicates by screaming or crying or kicking or grabbing what he wants. I am infinitely sad. He will never get married and have children, let alone be a doctor or a lawyer. My dream of having nachat, pride, for my son is shattered. Do you have any wisdom to share with this broken and exhausted mother?
I don't know about wisdom. I could share with you a broken heart at hearing about your shattered dreams, your disappointment. That soul that was sent to you, that was in your womb, that you brought into the world, that soul had your name and your husband's name written on it at the beginning of time. And it was not a mistake. It was sent to your address because the one who created us knows that the only one on earth who will be able to get over her disappointments and shattered dreams and to shower this child with infinite love is you. Nobody else, only you. Your name was written on the soul. That's a responsibility that none of us pray for and none of us expect, none of us. But this is exactly what was prepared for you. And that means that God has given you the strength and the ability to recalibrate and to reset and to look at this child and to raise this child and to have, I know it's going to sound strange, tremendous nachat, tremendous, tremendous love and pride. Tremendous love and pride. But my dear friend, as long as you're dwelling upon the disappointment of what could have been and what you were hoping would be, I'm afraid that you're not going to be able to appreciate the loveliness of this child. I'm afraid you're not going to appreciate the holiness that this child brings out in you. Because the holiest people that I have met in my life are the ones that have special children. Again, I don't wish it upon anybody. But those people that I know who have been able to get past that first stage, sometimes it takes years to get that past that first stage of horrible disappointment and the immensity of the responsibility, that feeling that's overwhelming. Those who get past that are filled with pride. I know I have congregants, I have students, I have friends who are filled with pride, who are able to see in this child not only the innocence of pure love, but to give a type of love to this child, to bring out within you a reservoir, to draw from a reservoir of love that you would not have ever, ever drawn from with your doctor of a son, with your doctor or your lawyer of a son. You wouldn't have found the reservoir of love within yourself and with your husband. So I want to bless you, that you and your husband, this should deepen your relationship. And that this child, you should see that this child is a blessing, not a curse. This child is a very, very great blessing to you and to your husband. And you will be able to have years and years and years of pride and joy. Just you have to let go of that disappointment. How to do that's not for, I have no words of wisdom for that now. That's a conversation for a different type of a conversation. It's not for in public. But as soon as you let go of that, and you're able to see this child as one of the pure souls that is not marred by the ugliness of this world, that is pure and unstained by the ugliness of the world that we live in, you'll be able to have immense nacha. You'll have tremendous pride. And you will be also proud of yourself, because you will be one of those people that took care of one of these children that God wanted to send into the world before Messiah comes. And I'll tell you something else, my friend, that once Messiah does come, and this world is going to be perfected, then your child will be perfectly well. I don't know if he's going to decide at that point to be a lawyer or a doctor. I don't know. And by the way, that's not necessarily the sign of perfection. I know a lot of messed up doctors and lawyers, but your child will then be healthy, communicating, and that child will say to you, "Mommy, I know everything that you did for me. I know every smile, I know every tear, I know every single thing that you gave up to take care of me." And that day, who's going to have bigger nachas than you? The mothers of the doctors or lawyers? No. You're going to have the biggest nachas in the world. It's going to be soon, with God's help. You'll see.
Oh, thank you, Rabbi. With another question that was submitted before, I have a jealousy problem. I am envious of anyone who succeeds more than me or has more than I do. It makes me miserable, but I just can't get rid of this emotion. What can I do to feel differently?
The Bible tells us that jealousy is something that causes a person's bones to rot. What that means is it eats away at a person. Jealousy eats away at a person. The problem with the jealous person is that instead of focusing on himself, he's measuring himself vis-a-vis others. That means that if you're jealous of others, unfortunately, you're not focused on what you should be doing to improve your own life. You're measuring yourself by others. That could be for many reasons. I don't know you. It could be that you were judged a certain way when you were growing up, in a way that was not generous, in a way that was not loving. It could be that you've been through certain things in life that have caused you to feel that another person's success is somehow at your expense. The only way to overcome this most painful emotion of jealousy is that when you see somebody that the rabbis teach us, that when you see somebody that you're jealous of, this might sound silly to you, try it. Daven for that person. Pray for that person's success. It seems counterintuitive because here, the last thing in the world you want is that person to be successful. You feel that it's cutting into your life. You're not as successful as that person. If you start to pray for that person's success, at the same time recognizing that whatever blessings you have in life to be grateful for, to be thankful to God and pray to Hashem, to God, thanking him for all your blessings, and you pray for that other person to be successful and to ask God for help, that that person's success should be something that doesn't hurt you at all, you'll find that over time, by praying for the other person you're jealous of, that you begin to feel more empathy and you begin to see more of that person's difficulties and challenges as well. It sounds silly. It works. Not after a day or two. Try it. A week, two, three. Pray for those people. And you'll see you'll begin to empathize with them. You'll begin to recognize them not as individuals who are a threat to you, not as individuals who are challenging you or in some way make you feel bad about yourself, but other human beings, brothers and sisters, who are going through what they're going through just like you, and you'll have empathy and love for them instead of jealousy. Try.
Thank you, Rabbi. I think we have time for about one more question, which I'm going to read now. I have been in the hospital for 33 days and was just discharged yesterday, a rare neurological disorder. I said Shema twice, and one morning asked Hashem, if he needs me, if he still needs me, I think meaning alive, then to end my suffering. Much of the suffering is the disease, and much of it is because of medical people who pretend to know my condition, but don't, even the experts. The abject suffering and trauma is deep, deep, and beyond painful. Days I was being denied breathing assistance for no reason, as doctors watched me literally suffocating. I'm not suicidal, but some days I want to be discharged. I wanted to be discharged just to die at home rather than under the so-called care of mortal man. I'm in my 40s and this hit me at 30. I used to run and be active and joyful, and now it's hard being crippled and abused by the system so lauded by most. What does God want of my purpose? I used to teach youth and adults, and now I struggle with basic life skills. Medications are sometimes effective and sometimes not. I don't want to die at a hospital. What is the answer by the Torah?
Look, the question of why is it that good people suffer? I mean, I have been speaking about that a little bit over the course of this hour, but why is it that a person like yourself, so productive, a teacher, alive, vibrant, and so on, has been diminished in such a way? It really goes back to what I was saying to the wonderful mother of the autistic child 5 minutes ago. There was a great rabbi that I knew. He died, it must be 25 years ago. His name was Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik. He was a great genius, a descendant of great rabbis, and he suffered a terrible stroke in the prime of his life of teaching. He was a teacher of thousands of students, and he suffered a terrible stroke. He was a master of Talmud. His son-in-law told me once that he came into the hospital room or the rehab, and his father-in-law was reading a very, very simple section of the Bible, of the Torah, one that a person of his level would normally be like embarrassed to be caught studying. It's so elementary and basic. And he couldn't help himself. The son-in-law said to his father-in-law, the great rabbi, he said, this is what you're studying. So his answer was, when I was fully myself, when I was healthy and well, and I was a scholar, and many considered me to be a Talmudic genius, then that's what God wanted of me at that time. Now that I've suffered this stroke, I can barely read. I can barely look at a page for more than 2 or 3 minutes. And that's what God wants of me right now. That's what God wants of me right now. What could I do? If I would have your name, I would daven for you. I would pray for you. All of us could daven for you together. All of us will daven for you. We'll get your name. That you should be able to be back on your feet, and that this disorder should be resolved. And that these people who are posing as doctors but who are not helping you, that they should be replaced by true messengers of God. There are some wonderful doctors, and by true messengers of God who will be sent by God to relieve you of this terrible suffering that you're going through. But for the moment that you're in right now, the Torah's view is, this is exactly what God wants you to do right now. Not to teach, not to do what you were doing before, but to do what you're doing now, which is, under the circumstances, whatever is the best you could do. Whether it's making phone calls to people who could use a kind word, whether it's thinking with your imagination of things that you could do to distract yourself from your own suffering by doing kind things with your limitations to help other people. You know, some of the most effective teachers, by the way, of those who are people who have suffered. I know many people in recovery, people with addictions who are in recovery, that they go around the country helping kids and adults who are going through addictions and so on. So too with you. You're, with God's help, you're going to recover, and you're going to help others who are suffering. Prepare now. Start now. Talking to others, teaching others. You're still a teacher. See what you could do to give of yourself to others while you're in this situation. Don't wallow in the anger towards the doctor. Get good doctors, but don't wallow in that anger. Don't wallow in misery and pain. As terrible as it is, stay focused on the good that you could do in your present situation. You're limited, just like that great rabbi. You're limited. You're not the healthy, vibrant person that you were. But even in the situation that you're in, you can give life to a lot of people. You could still be a teacher. You still do a lot of great things. I want to give you a blessing on behalf of all of us, that you should be strong, healthy, and well, and do great things with your life.
Thank you, Rabbi. I believe that we are out of time, but I want to remind everybody that they can continue to learn more from Rabbi Weinberger. First of all, subscribe on social media or by the email on the My Jewish Question website to continue to hear more. And also, you can go to a website called yutorah.org. That's the letter Y, the letter U, like Yeshiva University, yutorah.org. There's over 5,000 lectures from Rabbi Weinberger on all different topics available there by MP3. And you can listen to those live streaming, download, whatever. So that's it. Moshe, anybody else? Rabbi Weinberger, am I missing anything?
No, just I repeat what I said at the beginning. I really look forward to meeting you all in person, and we should be able to hang out a little bit together in Jerusalem in good health, all of us together. All of us together, whoever's suffering, no more. Get out of bed, come to Jerusalem, and let's have some pita and falafel together.
Amen.
And on Pesach. Pesach matzah.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Okay. Everybody should be well. Have a happy Pesach. Have a good Yom Tov, everybody. Thank you.